I still hate it. I'll never embrace it. I don't think it's basketball. You know, I think it's like a circus sort of thing. You know, and why don't we have a 5-point shot and a 7-point shot? You know, where does it stop? You know, that sort of thing. But that's just me. That's just old school. But to a certain degree, you better embrace it. You're going to lose. And every time we've won a championship, 3-point shot was a big part of it.
That's Greg Popovich, one of the greatest and grouchiest coaches ever. Hating on the three in 2015. But compared to this NBA season, where pretty much everybody is channeling their inner Steph Curry, 2015 feels old school. We're at the point where basketball's head in the clouds futurists, and it's yelling at clouds purists, are joining forces to wonder, is the shot that helped save the game now one of its biggest threats? I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, March 10th. This is ESPN Daily. So we were chatting before we started recording, and you described the conversation we're about to have as a total dork fest.
It's geeky, but it speaks to one of the material realities of this game right now.
Kevin Arnovitz has covered the NBA for ESPN for more than a decade.
I mean, it is everything in the NBA, the three-pointer, as we saw on Sunday night.
Steph Curry from near midcourt.
Not fair.
Please.
It's not fair.
The most threes and a half, seven by Russell Westbrook and by Kawhi Leonard. Here's number seven.
There were so many three-pointers in that All-Star game. I think 60% of the shots taken were three-pointers. But what in a sentence, Kevin, is the problem that you are here to analyze for us today?
Too much of a good thing. I am not someone who comes from the whatever happened to the post game. You know what I really love is Patrick Ewing and Alonzo Mourning wrestling in the post. I love modern basketball. Basically, the origin of this was, you know, we can't really reach the players. It's hard to get to games. I haven't been to one in some time. So, you know, sort of pick up the phone and call folks and say, hey, what are some interesting, and I said structural issues with the game. And I thought we'd talk about business. But what everyone wanted to talk about was the three-pointer was out of control, including some of the people you might associate with what is often and apocryphally called the analytics movement. So the people who were most influential in emphasizing the three are now saying, wait, like it is stilted the game.
So in terms of what the imbalance looks like right now, just for people who aren't as well-versed in the X's and O's, Kevin, of the game, how predictable is it for you to sort of know, oh, this is how this is going to go, and I know that this shot will be coming from beyond the arc?
We are now talking about, on a regular night, games with 96. And I like that number because it basically says two a minute. You know, regularly 96 threes being thrown up. And it's getting more and more common. I mean, I think when you look at, hey, games that had 75 three-pointers or more, and you query that, you just get a ton of games from 2019 on. I don't want to say it's bad. I'm saying let's be on guard for an undue influence and that it's disproportionate power. I mean, we all love the three. I love watching Steph Curry be Steph Curry.
Curry, way downtown, bang, bang! Oh, what a shot from Curry!
I don't want to see Damian Lillard stop doing what Damian Lillard does.
Lillard, long range three, and it's good! At the buzzer!
What I would like to see stop happening is Naz Reid, the backup center for the worst team in the league, taking half a dozen in his 18 or 20 minutes a night.
Naz Reid now for three. It's short. Westbrook's got the...
No disrespect to the young man who I think is shooting in the mid-30s from that range or the low 30s. And so that's really the issue. The three-pointer represented 23% of shots in 2011 and 2012. Like, Pablo, this is not the Stone Ages. This is the age of Ray Allen. I mean, this is the age of, you know, J.J. Redick. I mean, this is not ancient history. It's now approaching 40% of all field goals attempted.
Wow.
And so what I like to say is, like, anyone plays Scrabble, right? Like, you got these common letters that are 1 point, you know, you get an M, it's like 3 points, you get up to K, it's 5 points, and then the Q and the Z are 10 points. But like, what would happen to Scrabble if, like, you just flooded the game with Z's, right? Like, it wouldn't be Scrabble anymore. But what can we do where it really truly is the novelty and the special thing you wanted to do? It used to be exciting when someone hit a three. Now it's sort of commonplace. I think it happens every minute, you know, more than every minute in the game now.
But what is so interesting about that, Kevin, to me, is that the abundance, this surplus of threes, it's the result of a very deliberate decision from the NBA itself. Because let's remember here, in the 80s and really the 90s, the sport was super physical. We had giant defenders grabbing and hand-checking, all of which tamped down shooting and scoring. And while a giant and very sweaty knot of bodies down by the basket is how I remember the glory days of my childhood New York Knickerbockers, it wasn't the most beautiful game, admittedly.
You think about those WrestleMania games in the late 90s. And yeah, I know you're a New Yorker, and that's the last time the Knicks were ever good. But
sweat and elbows, man. Sweat elbows and Jeff Van Gundy dangling from the leg of Alonzo Mourning like a koala bear.
And fists are flying at the other end. Larry Johnson is one of them.
Here we go.
Oakley and Mourning have at each other.
And look at Van Gundy just holding on.
Those are the principles of New York Knicks fandom in the 90s.
Yeah, but for the rest of us, it was just like my eyeballs were bleeding. And I think there was, the Jerry Colangelo committee, which was given really unilateral power by David Stern to say, fix it. And they fixed it.
So at the time, Jerry Colangelo, Kevin, he was one of the league's most influential executives. He is an NBA lifer. He is somebody that David Stern really trusted to figure out how to make the game better. And in the year 2000... he got a bunch of people together to basically find ways to get players to shoot more.
Right. I mean, you were talking about important playoff games being played in the 80s and 70s, right? It was a slog. It was just wrestling bodies down on the post, trying to get position. There wasn't a lot of ball movement. The paint was clogged. And because, you know, shooting from distance was really, you know, it was the domain of the Don Nelson's team. It was a cute gimmick, but it could never win you anything because physicality was king. And so the league realized in around the 2000-2001 that this is just not good for the product. Basketball is a beautiful game at its purest, but we weren't getting any purity. We were getting a really foggy glass. And so the committee met and said, what are some things we can do? Actually, the three-pointer was already in place, but what they did was really loosen defensive rules. You weren't allowed to do much to impede the guard. So what happened is now you get this generation of guards who can penetrate at will. Well, what happens when someone penetrates at will and gets into the teeth of the defense, as we like to say? Well, the defense from the perimeter collapses on that guy because you got to pick him up. Well, what happens when the defense collapses? Now there are shooters out on the wings who are open. Now, what happens if those shooters become really proficient? And not just one guy, but now we have two shooters on the floor. Now we have three shooters on the floor. Now teams are effectively telling, you know, marginal in sort of rotational players, like, you better be able to shoot from three or you're not going to get on the floor. But it's just understood now. You're going to have four shooters, you know, surrounding, you know, James Harden. And I think there's a kind of a cult of sameness in the league, which is really flattened out style to the point where when you're watching Detroit or Washington or Portland, it kind of all looks the same. And I put the objections into three categories. One is the aesthetic. Hey, every team is starting to look the same. It's just not attractive basketball the way we saw in 15 and 16 and 17 teams trying to beat you with the pass. There was this, you know, great diversity of styles. You still had a Memphis Grizzlies team that was playing slow double post basketball. Then you had the run and gun teams and the Spurs were beating you with the pass. The second is competitive. And what it means is that, look, the whole point of awarding 3 points when it was instituted in 1979 was it's a much harder shot. You should get more in exchange for that effort. Yes. Well, it's not a harder shot anymore. Guys kind of come up and develop this shot from a very early age. And frankly, you know, you start looking at some of the player stats and they're actually more proficient from three than they are from two of a certain distance. And the other is sort of metaphysical, I call it. And this is what Dwayne Casey, the coach of the Detroit Pistons, really a defensive, one of the great defensive gurus of the game in the last 10 years, saying, look, the game's not about coming up and just jacking up threes indiscriminately. He called it sort of the soul of basketball is getting lost. I mean, here's a perfect example. Top draft pick Anthony Edwards. Do you see that dunk the other night?
Anthony Edwards with the exclamation point.
Wow, great stuff. I mean, you want to see this guy flying through the air, slashing, doing things that warranted picking him number one. I'm watching the game against the Milwaukee Bucks. He's shooting like 8 out of 13 of his field goals from three, and not very proficiently, by the way.
Edwards again misses from three. Edwards for three again. It's well short this time. Edwards for three again. Not this time, but Vanderbilt.
It's a bad shot aesthetically. It's a bad shot when great athletes are just roosting out, where it's just guys parked at the corner, high pick and roll. And my problem is you have guys who can do much more. But at the end of the day, they're most effective standing in the corner. Which, by the way, good intention, Pablo. We wanted to space the floor. The game was ugly 20 years ago.
What you're saying is that the idea that we have these incentives to this degree, that is creating a bad entertainment product.
Right. And so it would be, using the Scrabble thing, where there were a ton of cues running around that board, and guys, time after time, were putting qua. Right? like, what if there was a Scrabble game?
The cheat code of Scrabble.
Right, like 30% of the turns were qua. You know, and like count up the letters. You got your Q, you know, and that's what this is, right? Like, it's not that, you know, qua is a good word. You know, you're kind of stuck. You got that Q. You want to lay it down on a colored tile. We're all good. But I don't want qua every third turn. So that's what we're talking about. You know, perhaps it's time to at least start the conversation in the NBA's competition committee, where a lot of new rules are explored and ultimately implemented, and say, what could we do to possibly stem this, where we don't get rid of the value of the three? In fact, we enhance the value of the three by saying we're going to limit its supply.
All right, coming up, the surprising voices who are pushing for change and how the three-point shot might evolve.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
One of the voices in your piece that jumped out at me and almost slapped me through the screen is Daryl Morey's. Because Daryl Morey, the progenitor of the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, the former GM of the Houston Rockets, the current GM of the Philadelphia 76ers, and president of basketball operations there, hearing from him and hearing that he is concerned about too many threes, Kevin, on the one hand, I understand it. On the other hand, it's kind of like Joey Chestnut telling you, hey, man, I think you're eating too many hot dogs. Like, isn't there some amount of almost comic, I don't want to say hypocrisy there, but when did Daryl have his sort of come to Jesus moment when it came to threes?
All right. So the real cynic would say when he went to a team that had fewer three-point shooters, like the Philadelphia 76ers. But I don't think that it's Daryl Morey and the Houston Rockets said, we love threes. I think it was a guy who says, let's find the most efficient way to win and get that hack into our offense, right?
As a means to their end.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, one of what Daryl Morey, you know, said is you want there to be in any game this multiple paths to victory, right? And, you know, and it used to be in the NBA, hey, there are multiple paths to victory. We can beat you inside. We can beat you outside. We can beat you moving the ball around and, you know, kind of motion oriented. We can run fast. We can be slow. And I think now what we're seeing is there's kind of one way to victory. And oftentimes, you know, we love variance because it produces upsets. But there is a sense where, okay, whoever makes their threes wins.
Kevin, I have to admit, it is infuriating when we have a player like, and this will surprise nobody who listens to this podcast or me on television at all, but we have a player like Ben Simmons. I mean, the comparison I make for Ben Simmons is this dude is basically a flying car without a stereo. Like, he can do a million things. He just can't play music for you. He can't shoot threes, but he can do everything else. And yet, he gets ragged on so much because he does not shoot three-pointers, as if that was ever a thing a guy who was 6'10" was expected to do.
I don't necessarily want him shooting threes and as a product. Anybody can shoot a three. Who can do what Ben Simmons to do? I want him double, tripling, and quadrupling down. I would like a game that would be hospitable enough to Ben Simmons, where if he didn't develop that skill, oh, so what? Now, some would argue that's what's going on. He was on an all-star despite this deficiency. And so, yeah, he'll continue to hear it. And you know, that's okay.
So, Kevin, it's time to be solutions-oriented. And when you look at the problem of balancing offense and defense in the modern NBA, I do wonder how much you want to set the time machine back a decade or so, or two decades or so now. Are you intrigued by the idea of, hey, let's actually bring hand-checking back to make sure that this whole dribble penetration leading to more threes problem, maybe that's part of the solution here.
Yeah, I don't want to bring hand-checking back. I don't. That to me, impedes guards too much. I still want them to do the things they do. But I think there's probably a happy median between aggravated assault, which is what it used to be, and the day spa it is now for guards, right?
Like, so you want the eucalyptus leaf lightly slapping at offensive players?
Yeah, I don't need the essential oils, but like, you know, there is something in between. You know, letting guys get a chest up. Look, everyone's going to complain, but I really think the critics have a point when they say you can't touch a guy. And I think there's probably a happy. I don't even think it's a median. I think it could be still closer to day spa than aggravated assault. Just, you know, dial it back a little bit. And then that still gives a defense a fighting chance against just great pick and roll players, guys who can explode off the dribble and just lacerate a defense.
And in terms of the big men who are sort of caught in this weird world where they're trying to defend the three, but they're also trying to protect the rim, like, what can they do within this modern context? What rules might help them?
I think if you allowed the big man to kind of zone the basket area, as of right now, he can only spend 2.9 seconds away from his man, who increasingly is out on the perimeter. And so you do get sort of this red carpet for a lot of these guards to the lane, and then it's too late to recover, or the defense collapses, and then you dish it out to the three-point shooter. So I think by allowing the big man to really deter and make the guard think twice about going all the way, you know, now you still do some cool things. You'll have a floater and the teardrop and whatever else. But I also think you would limit some of those passes out because now the defense isn't collapsing on every single drive. I mean, I think there's this misnomer right now, nobody's playing defense. I don't think that's the case. I think defenders are working. I think it is impossible for five human beings to be stretched out all the way to 30 feet right now and cover that much ground against athletes of caliber we see in the NBA. Guys are trying. There's only so much they can do.
So as a legislator, Kevin, those planks of your proposed rule changes, those are pretty moderate. I think they appeal to the old school. I think those are passable. But I want to get to the more radical stuff because you write in your piece about a far more blunt instrument that can totally alter the landscape we're trying to fix here. What is this radical proposal that a so-called league power broker mentioned to you?
Yeah, who prefers to remain nameless unless it gains traction, in which case we'll probably celebrate.
The classic offense. League power broker.
Right. Let's cap the number of three-pointers a team can attempt over the course of a game. Mm. So in other words, over the first 36 minutes, because I think we all agree we love to see the final 6 minutes. Anything goes. Teams need to come back. We love the three-pointer in that context. But in the first 36 minutes, let's limit it to 20 attempts. Now, when I say 20 attempts, you can keep attempting shots from behind the line after those 20, but they're only going to count for two. And so what this would do is teams would have to be really selective and strategic. You know, Giannis Antetokounmpo is going to think twice about coming down and firing up with 16 left on the shot clock, because every three-pointer he takes is one fewer for Chris Middleton, who shoots at a 43% clip, or Bryn Forbes, who is truly a specialist at 45%. You know, you want to save them from where they're really good looks when you can leverage the defense. And they would have to ration their attempts. Do you want to blow all those attempts by, you know, halftime? No, because in the third quarter allows the defense to sort of tighten up in the inside and make it a little harder for your guards and your postmen. So I kind of love this idea. Purists will be like, oh, you can't do that. It changes the fundamental nature of the game, as if Moses came down from Mount Basketball in 1979 and said the three-pointer is this act, you know, this sort of, you know, act of God. No, it didn't exist prior to 1979. It was implemented to do something for the game, and now we have different goals and objectives, right? By the way, 20 is not chopped liver. Like, 20 is a lot. The 20 would be, I think, what teams average
back in the day,
not so long ago.
Right. Back in the day, 23 pointers was a cornucopia. Right. It was bountiful.
Right. This is not draconian, but I would love to see it tested in the NBA's official or unofficial laboratory, which is the G League, where a lot of these cool rules can be tested for kind of competition quality.
I want to ask you about another radical proposition here, Kevin, that I've heard bandied about in the back corridors of nerd fests like the Sloan Conference. What about, like, moving the three-point line back? What about the dimensions of the court? Where are you landing on actually changing the physical dimensions and the location of the three-point line itself?
I mean, actually, I'm for widening the court a little bit, just because I'm tired of seeing heels on the line because the corner is so small. But I got to be honest, I think the unintended consequence actually goes in the wrong direction. I think if you extend the three-point line, now defenses are stretched even farther, and guys will just learn to do what Dame and Steph can do and Trae Young, which is shoot from 30. And now you've got to cover a guy out to 30. Well, what does that do to penetration? Makes it even easier, which makes the collapsing even more distant. So to me, I think there's actually that could exacerbate the problem. That's just me personally. We'd have to see it in effect. I think the immediate product would be, yeah, I think that first year before guys can catch up to the distance, you might see, I think, a good shortfall in threes relative to this season. But I think over time, they'll just adapt, and then you have even a greater problem.
So the weirdest of the weird solutions here, Kevin, involves something our friend Tom Haberstroh has written a lot about in the past for ESPN.com and elsewhere, which is the four-pointer. And it's worth refreshing our memory here. The three-point line right now is 23.75 feet away from the hoop. But Tom was talking about this four-pointer that would be at 28 feet. And how does that idea sound to your ear?
The initial proposal by our friend Tom Haberstroh, that was some years ago before 28 feet became commonplace. I would actually move it out a little. So I'm torn. On one hand, I love it as an idea. And, you know, to the extent that we need to have fewer threes, why not siphon some of those off to four and really kind of, you know, put something at stake? On the other hand, I do worry that guys will become so proficient at it that it will just add to the spacing problem, no different than kind of moving the line back or changing the dimensions of the floor. But I kind of love it. I mean, I would love to see it instituted on some level.
So, Kevin, what I'm realizing hearing you analyze all of this is that what started off as a dork fest is kind of trying to reach across the aisle to the alleged cavemen in basketball. Do you think there is a compromise? Do you think there is a political alliance that can be forged here?
I think there already is. I think you're going to start hearing about potential remedies in the NBA's competition committee. I think there are enough people inside the game who know that this trajectory is not sustainable. You have older school people combining with new school folks. And both camps, I think, have an agreement, which is why maybe you see some reform, because there is a real political coalition across the aisle that I think says enough is enough, too much of a good thing.
Kevin Hartovitz, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, up next, how a hockey family paid back a favor and saved a life.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Here's another story I want you to know. You can't just play hockey anywhere. So to a hockey family, the manager of the local ice rink is a powerful figure, someone who controls the most precious of resources, time. In the town of Seaforth in southern Ontario, that timekeeper was a man named Graham Nesbitt. Nesbitt was the arena manager who'd get up early to open the rink at 6:30 in the morning so eager young hockey players could get ice time for free before school. Nesbitt was the guy who'd always stay late to keep the ice open well past closing time so those same kids would choose to skate instead of get into trouble after school. And in a town of less than 3,000 people like Seaforth, that kind of generosity mattered. It mattered to one of those kids, Ryan O'Reilly, who was now the Stanley Cup-winning captain of the St. Louis Blues. And it mattered to Cal O'Reilly, Ryan's brother, who'd go on to get drafted by the Nashville Predators, never forgetting all the snow days and lunch times when Nesbitt opened those arena doors. And it naturally mattered to Ryan and Cal's mom, Bonnie O'Reilly, who watched her sons benefit profoundly from so much extra time on the ice. So when word spread that Graham Nesbitt needed help, serious help, the result of an extremely rare kidney condition called Berger's disease, which was now threatening his life, many people in Seaforth got tested as the O'Reillys posted calls for help across the internet, hoping that somewhere they might find a match. And then they did. Last week, Bonnie O'Reilly successfully donated a kidney to Graham Nesbitt, now age 65, effectively saving his life. "What you've done for my boys," she explained, helping them achieve their goal of playing professional hockey. "It's the least we can do." The St. Louis Blues posted a photo of Bonnie O'Reilly and Graham Nesbitt recovering in the hospital in neighboring beds, wearing matching blue scrubs. And from behind their surgical masks, you can see their eyes smiling as they are both giving a thumbs up to the camera. Two generous people who know the preciousness of time. I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.